T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
All right. When you hear that music, you think of the NWO, which is arguably the greatest faction in wrestling history. And it was the creation of our next guest, who is the former president of WCW. He hosts a very highly rated podcast called 83 Weeks, because he beat Vince McMahon, and then known as the WWF, now known as the WWE, for 83 straight weeks in the ratings. Destroyed them, had them on the brink of bankruptcy, and then actually ended up working in the WWE thereafter. Eric Bischoff joins us here on WEI. Eric, thank you very much for making time on a Sunday. How's everything going?
It's going great here in beautiful Cody, Wyoming, in the heart of the Rocky Mountains. A beautiful day. And by the way, that music intro you gave me, it never gets old.
No.
It's like classic Jimi Hendrix or Rolling Stones. It's just never.
It is like that. When I hear that music, that thing, and you go back, Eric, to the summer of 1996, prior to Bash at the Beach in Daytona Beach at the Ocean Center. And you go back to that time. But, you know, the wrestling business was sort of stagnant right prior to that. And, it sort of been largely built on cartoonish characters with, you know, the WWF and Vince McMahon. And then you were able to pull off a huge coup. You were able to coax Scott Hall and Kevin Nash to come over from the WWF, come into WCW. Then at that point, how did you create this thing that we ended up known as the NWO, the New World Order?
Well, just to back up a little bit, I didn't really coax anybody, to be honest. I wasn't really paying too close attention to either Scott Hall or Kevin Nash as Diesel. Scott Hall as Razor Ramon in WWF. Neither one of them were really on my radar screen. They actually coaxed me, if anything else. And by coaxing, I mean they made themselves, they made it known that they were available and they were interested in making a move. So I took advantage of their desire to leave WWF versus me coaxing or convincing or otherwise enticing them, number one. And as far as, when the idea started to crystallize and how that relates to Scott and Kevin's availability, some of it was just timing. You know, the premise of the NWO idea, the story itself and the approach to it, was something that I had been thinking about for maybe a couple of years in studying really what was working over in Japan and how wrestling was presented to the Japanese audience, which was a much more realistic, reality-based presentation, I guess, versus the cartoonish, overly animated, almost childlike presentation of the product in the United States by WWF and, at the time, WCW.
And so from that, you bring in Hall and Nash. They want to come over. You all, I believe, guaranteed contracts were something that was not offered at the time, which I believe maybe was something they want to work perhaps a little less, and yet there was something that was guaranteed Vince wasn't offering at that time. So then you bring them in. But then you have to do something where, hasn't been done, where you have to turn Hulk Hogan heel and you have to get that thing over with the audience, and you put it all together and it just worked and it completely took off. like gangbusters. And then all of a sudden, WCW and like the wrestling product that you guys had becomes this huge success. And then you have Vince McMahon on the heels. But let's go back to the Bash of the Beach. Why did Hogan agree at that point in his career where a lot of people thought, man, maybe he's going to be in the twilight? Why did he decide to say, hey, you know, this is a good time to do it?
Well, what was, you know, and the interesting aspect of the whole story and the timeline is that a year prior to Scott and Kevin coming over and the early stages of what was to become the NWO, starting with Scott Hall interrupting a Nitro match on May 27th, 1996, you know, teasing his big buddy, you know, the following week coming in. That's where Kevin made his appearance. Well, that 2 week period of time, Hulk Hogan was actually filming a movie in California and he was locked down on location. He wasn't able to leave. And a year prior, I had talked to Hulk about turning heel and he very elegantly in his own way threw me out of his house. We're brother until you've walked a mile in my red and yellow boots, you'll never really understand this character.
Right.
So I had given up on trying to convince Hulk Hogan to turn heel because he was very clear just a year earlier that he had no interest in that. But that 2 week period of time where we introduced Scott first and then we introduced Kevin, I got a phone call from Hulk on location in California. And he said, hey, brother, I can't leave. I'm on lockdown, but can you get out here? I want to talk to you. So I flew out to L.A., and at that point in time, Sting was going to be my third man. Again, Hulk Hogan had turned me down a year previous. I didn't have any reason to suspect that he'd be interested in changing his mind. So I was just moving forward, and Sting was going to be my surprise third man until I got out to California, and Hulk said, look, I've been watching what's going on, and who's your third man? And I didn't really want to tell him. I was keeping it that much of a secret. I didn't want any accidents. I didn't think he would tell anybody on purpose, but sometimes things just slip. And I said, well, who do you think it should be? As opposed to telling him it was going to be Sting. And he said, well, brother, you're looking at him. And it was right there and then, I think, as a result of having seen early on the potential and the momentum. And again, at that point, we hadn't even named it the NWO. We didn't have a real clear idea how we were going to play it out long term. But Hulk, you know, threw his hat in the ring, was willing to turn heel, and the rest is history.
Eric Bischoff joins us here on WEI. Yeah, so then Hogan, he saw it. He liked it. He saw it was, he could tell that something big was about to happen. And then after that, and I had been, you know, me and a friend of mine, it was our college age. We just sneak into a lot of Monday Nitros and WCW pay-per-views back in the day. And you guys were rock stars. I mean, it was like this thing had just completely taken off. And then Monday Nitro becomes like appointment viewing. And you guys decide to, because you have the thing under Ted Turner, he lets you start a little bit early. And at that time, if I'm not mistaken, wasn't Raw taped for the most part?
Yeah, in the very beginning, you know, one of the things I did early on when I had my meeting with Ted Turner and Ted said, look, Eric, I want you to go, you know, head-to-head with the WWF in prime time on Monday nights. That was all Ted's idea. That wasn't Eric Bischoff's idea. I didn't go to Ted asking for it. I was actually meeting with Ted on a completely different subject, and he just changed the schedule for the meeting and wanted to talk about going head-to-head. So once I walked out of that meeting and I knew that I had a job of going head-to-head with the WWF, I knew early on, like the first day, that the only way I had a shot at not embarrassing myself and the company was to be as different than the WWF as I could possibly be. And one of the things at the very top of the list, and I literally made a list on a yellow legal pad of all the ways I could be different, not better, different than the WWE. And going live was at the top of my list because I've always believed that live TV, no matter what it is more interesting than anything taped. It just is. The potential of, you know, anything can happen. You know, that's something that you can achieve in live television that you really can't achieve in taped television. So that was the first thing I did is, you know, convince everybody that we had to go live. That was my idea. The idea of going a couple minutes early, you know, came out of a meeting that I had with Brad Siegel, who is the president of TNT. And we thought that would be a good way to hook the audience. We knew we were going to split the audience. That was obvious. That's why we went head to head. We intentionally wanted to split the audience. And we knew that if we jump started 3 minutes early, gave away their finishes, undermined any suspense or intrigue that the competition had, that we would give ourselves a tactical advantage. And that's exactly how it played out.
Now, did you realize at the time when you did what you did that it would turn into this revitalization? And I mean, you had taken WCW to heights that, I mean, WCW really, I don't even know if it even competed much with, I mean, you know, it was the former NWA, but now you were beating Vince McMahon in the WWF. You had their two biggest stars, and you created this sort of angle where it appeared as if they were still working for Vince, which made it, as you mentioned, from what you learned in Japan, more realistic, which what fans just ate it up.
It did, you know, and I think, you know, so much reflecting back, you know, it's easy, I guess, to put myself over, put the collective team together, put them over, talk about how smart we are and what great vision we had and how we knew everything was going to work out the way it did. And none of that would be true, by the way. You know, we were, the idea that I had for the NWO, I felt passionately about. The basic premise, even before we actually named it the NWO, which is an interesting story in and of itself. But
Hold on, back up right there. Well, how did the name come about? I mean, this is great stuff. Cause I just learned something already that Sting was going to be the original third member, and then that did. So how did the name come about? You can't gloss over that, Eric. Let's go. Come on.
Well, literally, you know, because we hadn't. I know this is going to sound crazy, but everything happened so fast. We didn't really think about the name of the faction. You know, I thought about the whole NWO storyline more as a storyline than saying to myself, hey, we're going to create this new faction and we're going to call it X, and this is going to be their characters, and here's some of the things that we're going to do. I didn't engineer or create the story that way. I had a good idea of what the premise was and what the story was. And because we hadn't really thought about the NWO as a faction and didn't think about naming it, when we got to Bash at the Beach, the night of the event, the night Hulk Hogan was going to make his big, you know, character change or turn, if you will, Hulk Hogan got to the building late intentionally. I didn't want Hulk, you know, showing up the building early enough so that everybody would go, oh, Hulk Hogan's here. He must be the third man. I wanted to protect the secrecy and the integrity of the story. So I asked Hulk not to show up until about 8 o'clock that night, right as the pay-per-view started. And when he did show up, he went directly to my office and we started rehearsing, as we often did. Hulk and I had a great rapport, and I would play the stick man character and walk him through his interview and get him comfortable, because we didn't use scripts, especially for Hulk. And as I'm walking and talking Hulk through the promo that he was going to give after the big turn, as I'm laying it out, literally riffing, you know, ad-libbing on the spot, not sitting down and writing, just riffing, I said, Hulk, you're going to, this brother is the new world order. And as that was rolling off my tongue and out of my mouth, and it registered with me, I went, wow, that's really good. But I hadn't really thought of it, you know, up 10 minutes before that, I hadn't really thought about what are we going to call this. It was just spontaneous. And Hulk heard it and he went, whoa, that's strong, brother. And that's how it became the NWO. It was like spontaneous creativity, I guess, or a spontaneous creative moment, if you will, that took place in rehearsing that promo, you know, a couple hour, an hour, probably hour and a half before Hulk went out to give it.
Eric Bischoff here on WEI. Eric, so when was a point that after that all happened at Bash at the Beach that you had started to create some serious traction and momentum, and everyone's talking, and you guys are blowing up? I mean, this thing is, as they say, getting lit at that juncture. But when did you sort of just stop for a second and realize, like, wow, we're doing something pretty unbelievable right now?
You know, there was no stopping at that time. And we had already started creating some pretty significant momentum prior to July of 96. Just going head-to-head with WWE created its own buzz, and we were far more competitive rating-wise than I thought we would be coming out of the shoot, to be honest about it. So we had already started building some momentum, and we're beginning to feel like we were on the right track. But clearly, you know, the night of Bash at the Beach and beginning the following Monday night and continuing on for a period of several months, the momentum was so huge, so fast, and we created such a buzz that I didn't really have time to stop and think about it. It really wasn't until probably 6 months in or 8 months in, when, you know, in 97, the fall of 97, winter of 97, that I really started to have enough time to go, holy crap.
Yeah.
We've really turned not just WCW around. We had already started doing that from a financial perspective. And we're turning WCW into a profit center for the first time in its history at Turner Broadcasting. That we'd already achieved, or we're beginning to achieve. But the sheer scope of the momentum that storyline created, and this new presentation between being live and more reality-based and introducing cruiserweights and bringing in a lot of international talent and completely changing the presentation of the product. It was probably late 97 before I had time to sit back and go, wow, we've really done something special here. When you're living it, it's a little bit like being on a treadmill.
Yeah.
At about 8 miles an hour, you really don't have time to look down and tie your shoe or, you know, answer a phone call, because you'll fall off that treadmill. That's the kind of pace we were keeping. It was crazy.
And the name of your podcast, by the way, joining us on the Harbor One Hotline is Eric Bischoff. The name of your podcast is 83 Weeks, because you did beat Vince McMahon and the WWF, as they were known back then, 83 straight weeks in the ratings. There was reports that Vince was on the brink of bankruptcy and he was going to possibly sell out and sell out to Ted Turner. Do you think that was like a possibility at that time?
You know, I don't know. I've heard different things, and clearly I worked at WWE from 2002 to 2006 or 2007 as a talent. I had a brief stint there this past summer as an executive. And you know, being close and being on the inside, you hear things differently than you hear them in the rumor mills outside. I don't know that they were ever on the verge of bankruptcy. There was no discussion of Turner buying them out, certainly not that I was aware of, and I probably would have been aware of that. But I do think that there was a tremendous financial pressure. And keep in mind, WWF had been hurting going into 93 and 94 and even 95 as a result of the after effects of the steroid trial.
Yeah.
That took a tremendous amount of resources, you know, mental, emotional, financial, and from a PR perspective, had a pretty, you know, devastating impact on the WWF. So they were already kind of on their heels. And then when Nitro comes along and we turn Hulk Hogan and go to a live format and all the other things that we did, clearly they were stressed out. But I don't know for sure if they were on the verge of bankruptcy. I never heard that from anybody internally.
So how did that all, after beating them for 83 straight weeks, and then Vince decides to go, like, I'm going to go all out right now. I'm not, you know, not rated R, but pretty close. And even though Vince gets credited with the Attitude Era, I really think that you and WCW started the Attitude Era with the NWO, even though people look back and have selective memories when it comes to that sort of thing. And they developed Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock and Triple H and all those guys. And then eventually, as they say, the rest was history.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. And again, I'm not objective. I try to be.
Right. Don't be objective, Eric. Just be you. Yeah, listen, you were on the other side. Don't be objective.
I think it's important that I am as much as possible. And with all that being said, I often chuckle. Now, I used to get a little perturbed, but now I just laugh when people talk about creating the Attitude Era, how the Attitude Era had such a big impact on the industry during that period of time. From my perspective, and I think anybody who is reasonably objective, the attitude, the click, if you will, the Attitude Era really was a manifestation of Nitro in the new format, in the new formula, in the new presentation that we created. D-Generation X was a reaction to the NWO. D-Generation X and the way it was presented was radically different within WWF at the time than what they had previously done, but the template was the NWO. It's so obvious to me that I think anybody that argues differently is just, you know, they've overdosed on their own Kool-Aid. It's just obvious. And the same is true with the whole Attitude Era. I don't think that Steve Austin necessarily, I think that was a separate kind of evolution of Steve's character that was a natural one with him that just kind of dovetailed into the Attitude Era. But certainly the change in presentation and going from a decidedly G-rated, almost kiddie type of programming that WWF was known for prior to the Stone Cold Steve Austin turn, the fact that the Steve Austin turn coincided with the reaction to the NWO, the new presentation, gave Steve a lot more latitude to be more over the top and to become a bigger character than he would have been had Nitro not come around and not kind of shattered the previously acceptable presentation of the product and targeting only children. And now we were targeting 18 to 34 year old males, 18 to 39 year old males, which gave us the opportunity, including the WWF. When I say us, I mean WCW. It gave WCW and WWF the opportunity to break free of that traditional childlike presentation and break into a more mature-themed, cutting-edge type of presentation that the Steve Austin character was able to flourish in.
After the whole thing went down and then you left, you were removed from the company, they bring in Vince Russo, and that was just like putting lipstick on a pig. That ended up being the unfortunate demise. Vince buys out WCW, and all of a sudden now he has control of the WCW name, their videotape library, and all that. And then you go to work for him. How surreal, what was that like when you went to go work for him in like the early 2000s, around 2002, and then you stay there for a few years?
You know, on one hand, it felt very surreal and otherworldly. And on the other hand, it felt very natural and like it was supposed to happen. It was really hard to describe. And, you know, not one of those emotions or perspectives at the time that I had was more dominant than the other. I was kind of constantly, I felt surreal every time I walked into a WWE venue where I was going to be working on any given day. It felt like, you know, I was behind enemy lines, so to speak, and wasn't supposed to even be there on one hand. And on the other hand, it was, you know, some of the best periods of my career as a performer. I mean, I enjoyed that period of time as a performer probably more than any other time in my career.
Wow. That's interesting to hear. So I would ask you this, because this was a big controversial thing where Vince McMahon, and there's reports out there that he was the only one who wanted to go through with this WrestleMania, the two-night event, in an empty gym in Orlando, instead of postponing it to keep that gate at Raymond James Stadium, the new home of Tom Brady and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. If you were in charge of the WWE, would you have postponed the event, or would you have gone through with it the way Vince did?
I honestly don't know. You know, it's a hypothetical question to a degree. You know, I wasn't in that position, and the reason I would hesitate to comment is because there's too much I don't know. You know, in terms of the risks and the precautions and the procedures that were put in place to mitigate those risks, there's so much that we don't know that it's hard for me to comment honestly on the decision that was made. I understand why, on one hand, Vince McMahon or anybody else that was voting for you know, continuing with WrestleMania. I understand why they would do that, and I also understand why there would be an argument against it. But without all of the background and the information and the knowledge in real time that was involved in making that final decision, I think it would be silly to comment.
All right, now they were going to do Thursday night the Hall of Fame ceremony, and they were going to induct the NWO, Hogan, Hall, Nash, and Six-Pac, otherwise known in WWE circles as X-Pac. Were you going to be a part of that?
No, no.
Okay, so, well, all right, and that to me is shocking. So in 2 weeks from tonight, ESPN's going to do a 10-part documentary on the 90s Bulls called The Last Dance. So basically, like, it's about, obviously, Jordan, Pippen, Rodman, and those teams that won six titles. To do a documentary on the 90s Bulls and not like have Phil Jackson is the equivalent of not having Eric Bischoff. Why not? Do you know?
I don't know. You know, and I know this is going to be this is going to sound strange to some people, but I don't know, but I'm not going to say it didn't bother me.
Oh, it should bother. Eric, you created the whole thing. How do you, like, it's like putting the, like, I mean, come on. Like, are you kidding me? It should bother you. It should piss you off. I'm pissed off for you.
Well, but I look at things differently. You know, I've said this before publicly, and I'll say it again here, because maybe it will help your listeners understand. But I'm all, you know, every time the Hall of Fame comes up for the last few years, I get a lot of social media commentary about, you know, whether or not I'm going to be inducted or should be inducted or shouldn't be inducted and all that kind of chatter, right? And I quit thinking about it a few years ago because, I kind of look at things from two different angles most of the time in my life. You know, from one perspective, of course, I'm a human being. I'm no different than any other human being. And all of us, I think, appreciate or look forward to being recognized by our peers in whatever line of work or interest we have. It's a human instinct to want to be appreciated or recognized. And I'm not any different than anybody else in that respect. But I think where I am a little bit different is I look at the Hall of Fame and from a fan's, because I am still a fan. I mean, I watched the first part of WrestleMania last night, you know, night one.
Well, what did you think? Please don't shy away. It sucked. But what did you think? What are you, like, pulling punches now? Come on.
Punches, but it's not a simple answer for me because I watched WrestleMania last night for two reasons. One, because I was curious.
Yeah.
I was curious how they were going to pull off such, you know, an event that has historically been such an extravaganza. It's known around the planet. It's one of the biggest live events in the world. It's massive in its scope in every possible way you can measure. And I wanted to see WWE was going to deal with the obvious challenges that were being presented. So curiosity was one. As a fan, there were certain matches, certain people that are on the card that I was very interested in seeing how they were going to adapt and adjust and present their story and their product. So that's the producer side of me. You know, the fan side of me, took a little bit of work for the fan part of me to really engage, because without the audience, it just feels alien. It feels like I'm watching a rehearsal for something as opposed to watching the actual event.
From someone who used to be in charge of, like, you know, like when a guy is on the front and cutting a promo, and don't pull any punches because I certainly didn't. Grade Rob Gronkowski last night.
I hated it.
Thank you. Thank you, Eric Fisher. I was waiting for the scarlet letter red pen to come out. I thought it was, and you know what I was even worse, Eric? Was when they put these huge sunglasses on him so you couldn't tell he was reading.
Yeah, it's just everything about it was wrong to me. And it's certainly no fault of Rob's. He did the best he could under the circumstances he was working in. And he was taking the direction he was given. And he was, you know, the coach calls the plays, not the players, generally. And that's what the coach wanted him to do. But for me, you know, it was because the open, you know, the music opening, America the Beautiful, that was so amazing. I literally had tears in my eyes when that was taking place. That was so powerful to me.
Yep.
It moved me very, very much. And then the big, you know, the intro, you know, the with, you know, the high production values, the kind of Game of Thrones Tampa themed intro they did was so well done. It was so big. And, it, you know, for the first 5 or 6 minutes of WrestleMania last night, I felt like I was seeing that big spectacle, important show. And then to drop into an empty arena and to see Rob Gronkowski dressed up like Paul Diamond from the AWA back in 1980s. And acting like he was at a party with, you know, 3,000 other people in a hot club when there was nobody there. It was such a fish completely out of water type moment.
Yeah.
And it wasn't necessary. Rob Gronkowski is a large enough character in life without the gimmicks and without trying to thrust him into a wrestling character persona right out of the shoot. And I think if they would have downplayed the character part of that a little bit more and played up who Rob really is, because he is a household name to a lot of wrestling fans, it would have been better served. But who am I to judge? That's just my take.
All right, Eric Bischoff, a couple things I'd be remiss. Now, you came back last year and they named you the executive director of SmackDown. And then like 6 weeks later, you were gone and replaced by Bruce Pritchard. What happened?
Well, it was a little longer than that. It was about 4 months.
Oh, 4 months. Well, it felt like 6 weeks.
Yeah, well, it felt like 5 years to me. So.
Okay. Okay.
It all depends on where you're at. You know, I covered this. Conrad Thompson and I covered this on a podcast we did for Patreon about a week and a half or 2 weeks ago. And for the first time, I went into real detail and depth on it. For, you know, the discussion here, I'll just say it was on me. You know, Vince McMahon, I had a great relationship with Vince going in. We had a couple good meetings before I agreed to take the job or before he offered the job to me. I knew going in it was going to be a big job. But I think what I've learned in retrospect are two things. One is it's my nature. It always has been, probably, unfortunately, always will be my nature to underestimate challenges. I think I can do anything. I think I can adapt to anything. I think I can figure anything out. I've always been that way. And the truth is I can't, and I don't. And sometimes it just isn't right. But I never look at obstacles or challenges and say to myself, gee, I don't know if I can handle that, or I don't know if I want to tackle that, or I don't know if I can figure that out. That's just not who I am. And I underestimated how difficult it was going to be for me at this stage of my life to adapt to a system and a process and a culture that's really alien to mine.
Okay.
I think differently. I manage differently. I create differently than the process that's in WWE. And as a rational human being who's being hired at a very high level with a ton of responsibility, I knew going in that it was my responsibility to adapt to the WWE system. I knew going in that they weren't going to adapt to me. I was realistic about that, but I was unrealistic about my own abilities to adapt. And it just became clear to me, and obviously to Vince, he's the one that fired me. It became clear to both of us that it just wasn't the right fit. It wasn't chemistry. Well, I guess chemistry is a part of it, but there was no, and nothing was adversarial. There was no typical conflict that one might expect. It was just a matter of, I was a square peg in their round hole, and my square peg isn't going to change, and neither is their round hole.
Fair enough. A couple things I got to get to before I let you go. The Rick Rude gun story. Where you were maybe scared for your life. Can you just tell us the ravishing Rick Rude, the late, great Rick Rude, and why you were maybe scared for your life at one point?
Well, I'll back it up before I get you to the punchline. You know, Rick Rude, I had known Rick Rude since long before I ever got into professional wrestling. He went to a different high school in Minnesota than I did, but it was very close in proximity. We were in the same conference. We knew a lot of the same people. After we got out of high school, we hung around in some of the same bars and that kind of thing. So, and we had some mutual friends. So Rick Rude was somebody that I knew before I even got into the wrestling business. And I knew his reputation and all things that came with Rick Rude. But we were pretty good friends. And while I was in WCW, we were pretty good friends. But the reality is Rick Rude and Ric Flair were having a very, very heated battle between the two of them. At the time, Ric Flair was booking and Rick Rude didn't appreciate the creative, and it had escalated to the point where it was getting a little out of control. And there was one point where I had to take the belt from Rick at a Disney MGM Studios taping. We needed the belt. Rick Rude had it in the trunk of his car. And it came down during the conversation, well, if you want the belt, come down to my car and take it. Now, that conversation, that challenge to me from Rick Rude took place in front of a room full of people, and it was designed, I think, to have an effect that Rude wanted it to have. I only call him Rude because there was two Ricks in this conversation.
Right.
So, you know, Rude said to me, you want the belt, come down to my car and take it. And I wasn't afraid for my life because I knew Rick. I knew for sure he wasn't going to beat my ass. He wasn't mad at me. He was mad at Flair. I was just, you know, caught in the crossfire of it all. And I said, great, I'll do that. And I followed Rick down to his car, and he opened up the trunk of his car, and laying right on top of the belt was a, I don't know if it was a 44 Magnum or a 357 Magnum, but it was a big ass revolver, one of them big, dirty, hairy looking things. And he looked at the gun, and I looked at Rick, and I looked at the gun, and Rick looked at the gun, and Rick slowly reached down and grabbed the gun. Kept it right where it was for just a split second, got a little smile on his face, moved the gun over to the side, pulled out the belt, handed it to me. So it was a whole lot of for nothing, but I was pretty sure he wasn't going to shoot me.
Right, right. Eric, listen, man, I can't thank you enough for taking the time on, I guess WrestleMania Sunday. And real quick, would you ever get back into it if Tony Khan and AEW came calling?
You know, it's hard to say. I love what AEW is doing.
Me too.
I'm pulling for them in every way you can. But, you know, again, what I've learned at the WWE, it all depends on the situation. I'm way, way more attuned to what I'm capable of doing in terms of adapting and contributing at the same time than I was maybe, you know, 8 months ago. So it just depends. You know, there's no clean answer.
All right, Eric, listen, man, we appreciate it. And again, if the NWO is going to get inducted into a Hall of Fame without Eric Bischoff, there is no NWO. So I, in some sort of karmic way, the fact that that did not take place, even though I was going to be there Thursday night in Tampa, I'm glad it didn't, because if you're not in it, they shouldn't. I mean, let's just be real. So that's just how I feel about that. Thanks again, Eric, for joining us. Appreciate it.
Mark, my pleasure. Anytime, buddy.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.